This is the Technology Evangelist with Scott Schweitzer, and thank you for listening. Today's show is brought to you by Solarflare. In March, Solarflare is releasing their X2 line of secure 10 and 25 gigabit Ethernet NICs in both PCIe and OCP form factors. Unlike other performance NICs, this line is tamper-resistant and includes free line rate packet filtering and OS kernel bypass. To learn more, please visit solarflare.com. Hello, this is Scott Schweitzer, Technology Evangelist. Today I'm lucky enough to have with me my devoted friend Nick Capuzzo, who's a sales engineer at CC Integration, an integrator in San Jose. So, Nick, do you remember how we met?
As a matter of fact, I do, Scott. It's good to be with you today. I want to say it was 1985. We were both working for IBM Research at the Watson Research Center in New York. Somebody in my department had ordered one of the first commercial RISC computers. They hadn't been launched yet, so they had to be kept in a secure location. So they delivered one of these things to my cipher locked laboratory. It had to be, I think, assembled or had options put in. So they sent me to some guy who's handling this downstairs. Walk into your office and you have this model and you need two of these boards and let me show you. You know what this is? Of course you don't. Here you go. You're pretty damn funny. Funny and competent all at the same times.
Well, you were probably the 10th person I gave a computer to that morning. So I was probably pretty fried.
Oh, really?
Already. Yeah, after spending all weekend putting them all together. But
that's funny. Yeah, way back when. And then I remember played a little kitchen table poker together, and eventually I transferred to another division in Minnesota and then out to California. And I remember giving you the call from California saying, what are you doing? You want to come and work out here?
That's right. So I went out for IBM's supposed AdStar launch, where they were going to spin the disk drive business off like they did printing systems division, did Lexmark. They were going to spin IBM's storage systems division off as AdStar, which unfortunately never happened.
Sold a lot of disk drives, though.
Oh, yeah. We sold, what, $2 billion or something like that externally? In, what was that, 98, I think it was?
97, 96, 98, yeah.
98 was $2 billion was online in 98, yeah. It was a lot.
It was a good time. So, you know, having taken a walk down memory lane there, you're with Solarflare and you're into high-performance networking right now. And I'm kind of curious, I don't know that we've ever talked about exactly what led you into that.
After IBM Storage Systems Division, one of the things I went to, one of the companies I went to was NEC, Solutions America. And they had me working on Itanium chip, and they had an Itanium server. I was product manager for the Itanium server, which was really on the cutting edge of high performance computing. We had probably the largest Windows server you could build at the time. And that kind of got me into high performance computing. And then from there, I went to Miracom, which was a high performance networking company, later Solarflare, which is, I joined them back in 2013. That's where I am now.
Well, you know, so we're here today to talk about server networking. Just curious to, catch your views and maybe start out with some of the more basic stuff. They're so ubiquitous now. You know, servers are everywhere and there's so much online business. I think it'd be useful if we start kind of towards the basic, you know, for people who are not networking experts, and maybe you could rattle off like 8 or 10 types of servers, you know, by purpose. Just sort of suggest an example of each of what it does and so forth.
Sure. So let's first classify what a server is in relationship to, you know, your laptop computer or some other thing that you've seen. Servers are typically computers that are purpose built to do a specific thing. And as such, they generally don't have a lot of the fluffy, you know, user interface stuff that you see, you know, on your Windows desktop or your Mac. They're pretty stripped down systems, often running an operating system called Linux that's been around for over 2 decades. Classic examples of servers are web servers that provide you with the web pages, obviously, that we're all familiar with. Email servers for managing the email and organizations, application servers, where when you say application, it's kind of a loose topic, but it's more of a class of server for things like your CRM systems, your customer relationship management, your enterprise resource planning. They could be for databases, a wide range of kind of generic, more generic purposes. You also have high performance computing servers. Those servers are generally tuned towards doing different types of calculations extremely fast. So they might have high-performance GPUs or other hardware in them to assist them in doing things. Some of that could be kind of subclassed a little bit out for doing things like data mining, the stuff that Cambridge Analytics, for example, was in the news for recently. But that's Hadoop clusters, things like that. And then you also have cloud file servers, stuff like what Dropbox is known for, Apple's iCloud service. These are file servers that basically just keep all your stuff in the cloud, and they make sure that all your stuff is replicated multiple times across the globe so that if you're traveling, you can get access to it anywhere. And if a server goes down, it's totally transparent to you. You don't ever know that it's out. And then there's a special class of server called an appliance. And those servers are really kind of custom built, and the software on them is really tuned for a specific function. And they're delivered with the hardware and the software as one complete solution to a problem. So some people actually buy mail servers that are pre-built, or they'll buy security servers, intrusion prevention systems, or intrusion detection systems that are custom built using this kind of stuff.
What types of connections typically each one of those might have?
Yeah, so it varies dramatically depending upon how you want to deploy it, depending upon what that web server is going to do. You know, you do have to look at what it is you're trying to do, how many people you're trying to service, how many pages per hour if it's a web server, how many emails per hour, and kind of scale the things to fit. When they first started out, we only had single socket, single CPU, single core servers back in the late 90s. And then we, you know, ramped up to dual core and eventually dual socket. And now we've got dual socket servers that have, you know, 28 cores or more in some cases per socket. So you can do quite a bit in these, but they should be, you know, kind of tuned to fit.
Sure. You know what? Let's go to basically get you to define the different types of network connections to servers or maybe you could segregate them between, you know, copper and optical.
Sure.
And just sort of list them off.
Sure. So you've got a couple different options available to you. When servers first, you know, really took on prominence, gigabit Ethernet was just coming up, and that's kind of the network cable that we're all used to, that we've used in the office or even at home. It looks kind of like a telephone cable, you know, the connector on the end, something called RJ45. That cable is usually good for a gigabit connection, which is, you know, a billion bits per second. There have been some tricks that have been played in the recent past over the last 5 or 10 years to extend that to about 10 times the speed that it has available today. That's called 10G base T. You can use that same cable, you know, to make runs of up to say 30 meters at high performance levels like 10 gig Ethernet. But, as you find, you know, different servers need different networking capabilities, right? So for example, an email server might be fine with a pair of 10 gig ports, while if you were doing a Hadoop cluster for data mining, or, you know, a TensorFlow cluster for artificial intelligence, you might want a pair of 25 gig or 50 gig Ethernet connections. So there are different network speeds. You basically, you know, today most of the servers have moved over or are moving over to 10 gig Ethernet. 25 gig Ethernet has just come on the scene in the last year. Got 40 gig has been around for a while, but it's been kind of shunned because it's been pretty expensive from a media point of view. It was all fiber for the most part, and it was expensive fiber at that. And then now we have, with the advent of 25, we also have 50 now, which is really in essence a pair of 25s. And also 100 is just coming out, and that's generally four 25s bonded together. So, you know, you've got a bunch of different speeds, and then you've also got not only copper in the sense of the twisted pair stuff that we're all familiar with, you know, for gigabit Ethernet. But there's direct attach, which is a dual coax. It's good up to 7 meters. It uses the same SFP28 connector that you'll find on 10 gig Ethernet and 25 gig Ethernet. I should say SFP plus or SFP28. It used to be SFP plus, now it's SFP28. And then SFP28 is the upgraded specification for 25 gig Ethernet. And that basically stands for small form factor pluggable interface. And then the 28 is actually the native speed underneath which 25 gig is actually delivered. So you've got, you know, both copper and fiber. The differences between the two, if you can stick with copper, it's generally a cheaper solution, but your runs are going to be a lot shorter. Like I said, you know, 7 meters often or less, which is enough to go from, you know, the server in the rack to the top of the rack or to the top of a rack 2 or 3 racks away. Fiber allows you to do longer runs, you know, across the whole data center. In general, optical uses terminators called LC terminators. You basically have a receive and a transmit fiber. It looks like a single fiber. You can go, I think it's 200 meters on LC fiber using normal 810 nanometer light waves. So 200 meters is typically, I think, the run on that kind of stuff. Now you can go further than that, but you have to go to higher grade optics, using long range fiber. And I think your limit on that then is 10 kilometers. But the price goes up, you know, by a factor of four generally.
Right. So now that we've talked about the different types of connections, in fact, so at this point, can you say a word about, one might imagine that the paths into a server don't necessarily equal the paths out of a server. In other words, that, let's say, take a particular server and let's say we had, you know, four NIC cards in it, a couple of 1 gigabit Ethernet cards, and then maybe a couple of 10 gigi cards. Is there, I just would like your view on paths into a server versus paths out. The cases where that's very asymmetrical, or is there some virtualization that sometimes takes place that allows you to have kind of one path in, and then it's advantageous to have many paths out, or, you know.
Right. So if you take a look at a typical web server or an edge server today, you'll have 1 or 2 gigabit Ethernet interfaces that come standard on the motherboard. One of those is generally for a management port. If you have Dell servers, it's called an iDRAC port, and that goes off to a management network that's separate and apart from everything else. So that way they could manage that server from power up to power down, without actually having to go out and touch the physical box. There's also a gigabit Ethernet interface that they consider to be the production interface that you can use if you want. And then you have your stand-up PCI Express adapters. Either they're slotted into PCI Express slots, or they go into a LAN on motherboard type solution, daughter card. And that gives you your network connectivity. Now, more to your question, Nick, about asymmetric input-output, there's two aspects to that. When you connect to somebody like Amazon, you say, I want to go to www.amazon.com. It goes in and it hits a specific server called a web load balancer, or an application load balancer, depending upon who you talk to. That server gets the packet, and then it instantly says, okay, the least loaded server in my architecture that's available to me right in this locale is server number 12, right? So it hands the web request off to server number 12. That server then gets your web request. It then sends a connection directly back to your browser to say, hey, I'm the guy that's actually helping you out. You know, just acknowledge that you got my acknowledgement, and then there's a little handshake that takes place, and then that web server is connected to your browser, and it begins to fetch the content for your web page. On the back end, what you don't know on the back end is, you know, a whole bunch of network connections that go back into Amazon's cloud architecture, even more deeply than what's exposed on the edge, to fetch the images, to fetch the customer reviews, to fetch the content, the textual content for the page, to fetch all that other stuff. So while, you know, there might be a 10 gig connection in for web requests, data within the data center to service those could require 8 to 10 times the bandwidth to pull all that, those bits and pieces together, before, you know, the connection goes back out. So it turns out that, studies have been done in the last couple of years, and they found that if an organization has, you know, X amount of data coming into it, they probably have on the order of 8 to 10x the amount of traffic within the organization to satisfy the inbound outbound traffic. So it's really quite a fan out.
That's fascinating. Okay, so this is all great for setting the stage of where we are. You know, it definitely tees me up wondering what's coming up. You know, if you could kind of plane up, because we've been down fairly detailed with connection types and so forth. So if you were to go up to the 1,000-foot level in your view, do you have kind of a view, a vision of where you think server networking is headed, and why that is?
Yeah, good question, Nick. So as far as networking, we've been with 10 gig Ethernet since around 2003, 2004, and it's become pretty pervasive throughout the industry. 40 never really saw any pickup in any real volume. What we're seeing is the adoption of 25 gig Ethernet. And that's really starting to ramp up quite a bit the last 2 years. So we'll see a lot of pickup in 25 gig. Two 25s bonded together to form 50 will become popular for really dense networking needs. But we're actually starting to see an emergence now of a new 50 gig standard that's a serialized standard that is using something called PAM4, P-A-M-4. And that will allow us even greater densities. And that's designed to extend networking up to 400 gigabits per second. You know, that would be
that's fast.
Yeah, that's 8 50 gig links bonded together. But that's kind of where it's headed. Even for 50, though, if we look at the current PCI Express Gen 3 that's so common, a Gen 3 by 8 socket is good for about 52 gigabits per second effective throughput in each direction, right? You go to a 16 lane, which is what is typically used by the GPUs and other cards in the box. You can take that up to 102, 104 gigabits per second, roughly. So we're really kind of knocking at the door of needing PCI Express Gen 4, which is right around the corner. That'll double everything again, which I think will be a good fit for dual 50 gig cards in the near future. I think those will become a standard probably 4 or 5 years from now. But 25 will be the king of the hill for a while. And the benefit of 25 is that 25 gig Ethernet actually uses the same media and connectors that 10 gig did. The only difference is you have to be a little more sensitive to the cables. The quality of the cables in 10 wasn't as critical as it is in 25. So with 25, we had to introduce things like forward error correction, something known as FEC. We also do advanced concepts like link training, where we basically send a predetermined pattern of signals down, and we use it to kind of program the receiving end of the wire so that both parties know exactly what's going on. So there's some tricks we play. But at 25 will be the networking standard probably for the next couple of years, going to 50 probably in 3 or 4 years. And then after that, it will go up to 100 or 400. We'll see if what PCI Express does after that.
So your company, Solar Flare, we're talking about the network from a sort of a disembodied, or really the connections and from the point of view of the communications means between nodes. But there's a lot of exciting things that are happening really just on the NIC, you know, itself that relates not just to speed, but to security. I thought maybe you'd like to say a few words about that.
Yeah. So, we've got a new line of NICs that are coming out this week or have come out this week called the X2 series NICs. And one of the real benefits of, you know, being the company that designs the chip that goes on the network adapter is the fact that we can, identify areas of opportunity, long before they're needed in the market, and put solutions to those problems or opportunities into the chips. The lead time for this stuff sometimes is measured in multiple years. So what we've done is we've actually put a hardware filtering capability in the NIC that can be managed remotely off server by another third party server, such that, you know, if somebody were to compromise a server that had a SolarFlare NIC in it with this technology, which we call server lock, they could, you know, manipulate the software filter tables. The common one is IP tables or Windows firewall. The hacker could manipulate those because typically they escalate their privileges to root and they gain admin access over the box. And the first thing they do is they turn off all the security countermeasures, right? With our filtering technology being managed off server, a hacker that compromises the server would be totally unaware that the traffic on the server was being filtered. And he would not, even if he did become aware of it, he would not be able to manage those filters or modify them in any way. And so what ServerLock allows us to do is zone stuff off and actually, in kind of the Star Trek vernacular, cloak servers from the network so that the server only shows up and does what it's expected to do. And everything else, it basically is transparent to it. It just disappears. It's kind of a clever technique. We can support thousands of filters and we execute them in, hundreds of nanoseconds.
Wow.
Pretty cool stuff.
That's a level of sophistication that, unless you're aware of that corner of the space, you'd have no idea so much was going on.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to put, like a classical firewall in front of a server, a hardware firewall, like a Fortinet firewall, you're looking at 2,500 to 3,000 nanoseconds of latency to filter packets, right? We're doing the same thing in on the order of about 300-400 nanoseconds. So we're doing it in, a fifth or a quarter of the time. And we're doing it on the NIC. Yeah. Pretty cutting edge stuff.
Well, thanks for sharing your views and your thoughts and explaining all of this very useful information.
Well, thanks, Nick, for your time. And, how can people find you if they want to interface with you?
Just go online, ccintegration.com. It's all one word, .com. Maybe I'll just say a word about what we do.
Sure.
So in case there's anyone listening to this not aware of what a technology integrator is, you might have a company that develops some security appliance or, you know, some product that's distributed, you know, on a server, and they develop their code and they, you know, kind of develop their product, but they don't really want to be in the manufacturing business per se. And so we will partner up with these, with a customer, fill out a checklist of that has to do with everything from how they want to distribute their image to the servers to branding, literally even branding of not just the software, but of the box that the, you know, the product will be shipped in and so forth. And so CC integration takes all of that on, produces those servers, and then actually drop ships them to the customers if they had come from the company. So it sort of is a very good ROI story. It's a partnership that allows the company to use its resources to do what it does, which is its intellectual property and developing its products, and then leaving kind of that back end mass replicated, send it out to the masses, to a company that specializes in that. And that's kind of what we do. It's a great place if you want to work with servers. That's what we do day in and day out. So,
well, Nick, thanks for your time today, buddy. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Scotty. I want everybody to know that this particular podcast, if it's not already obvious, started out by me calling Scott to shoot the breeze, and then deciding, hey, you know, it'd be nice if you spent some time with me to give me your views on where the networking field is going. And naturally, Scott comes back and says, yeah, we should make that a podcast.
Hey, man. Anything to get a podcast out there, some good content. Well, thanks for your time today, Nick. This has been Scott Schweitzer for the Technology Evangelist, and Nick Capuzzo for CC Integration.